With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Well, welcome to All Brother, a podcast about Salford / Manchester's legendary musical institution, The Fall. You can find us at Spotify, Apple and all the usual suspects. As you probably know by now, we're hosted at play.acast.com/All Brother, and all episodes are also available on YouTube. Search for All Brother Podcast, obviously. And if you subscribe, you'll never miss an episode. This week, we're joined by two illustrious guests, Mr. Matt Goody, who's just written Needles and Plastic, the definitive history of Flying Nun Records, and Mr. Jonathan Ganley, photographer extraordinaire, to discuss the Fall's infamous 1980 tour of New Zealand. Hope you enjoy it. Oh, brother. Episode something of series 3. I can't think what number it is. Is it 4?
Anyway,
it doesn't really matter, does it? So the voices you hear, obviously, are me, Paul Hanley, and my brother Steve. Morning, Steve.
Oh, morning.
Yeah, we don't normally do these in the morning, but there is a reason why we're doing it in the morning today, because our guests too today are Matt Goody, who's editor, publisher, and more importantly for this podcast, author of Needles and Plastic, which is the history of Flying Nun Records. And we'll get into why Flying Nun Records have a place in the Fall history. And he's joined today by Mr. Jonathan Ganley, who's the photographer who took a lot of shots when we were in New Zealand in 1875, I think it was. So, good morning, gentlemen. Also, for purposes of the tape, as they say on crime fiction, Matt will be the Canadian gentleman and Jonathan will be the Kiwi. So you should be able to tell everyone, as you probably can't tell who me and Steve are, but you can be able to tell who the other two are. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Afternoon.
Good evening for us.
Good evening.
Yes.
Good
evening.
So what are you, 13 hours behind us, is it?
Yes, it's
ahead of you.
Oh, ahead of you.
Yeah. It's the
Of course you're ahead of you.
9:30 Friday night. Yeah. This is actually Matt.
So that was Friday. It was all right. It's not done much for us yet.
Yeah, you got a lot to look forward to. Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. Can't wait. So good morning, good evening, good afternoon. What we need to talk about today, I presume, will predominantly feature the Australian tour and New Zealand tour, more importantly, of 1982, which was, frighteningly enough, was 40 years ago. So the reason, one of the reasons is that Matt has written a book called Needles and Plastic, which is the history of Flying Nun Records, and we'll get on to Flying Nun Records in a minute, but it's a lovely looking book.
Thank you. Yeah. And that record features extremely prominently, and we'll get into the more details of that, as you said. But it's a standout record in the story of Flying Nun, for better or for worse.
Both of them. Yeah.
As, as usual with the Fall.
Yeah.
It's got its good parts. It's a bit of a curate's egg. how old are you, Matt, if you don't mind me asking? You weren't about then, were you? You don't sound too young to be around watching bands in 1982.
I'm in my early 40s, so I missed out on all of this. So I've come at it from a digging in the archives to try and piece together the very murky story of how that record came to come out and then disappear rather quickly.
Right. I've got Jonathan on your line. You have boots on the ground, don't you?
Yeah, I was 18 in 1982, and wanted to take photographs of bands, and the Fall was one of the first live bands that I photographed.
Oh, well, what a more auspicious start.
Yes.
And you carried on.
you were based in New Zealand. You didn't go to Australia, did you, for any of the gigs?
No, I was.
Right.
I was here, eagerly anticipating the Fall's arrival in August 1990.
Yeah. Which was, I think people, listeners might not understand what a big deal it was here. I've been going around on the tour here for the last 2 weeks, talking to the amount of bands that ended up being on Flying Nun, for example, that were at one of the gigs, particularly the Christchurch and the Auckland gigs.
Well, if the people, you need a younger roster. They need a younger roster, don't they? If all the people in London were at them gig.
They all, I was down in Dunedin, and everybody I was speaking to from a lot of bands, they all traveled up to Christchurch as soon as they heard that the Fall were coming. And
right.
They were all there.
We were like the New Zealand Sex Pistols, and weren't we?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. There's a name for it.
I'm always curious about how much you knew. I mean, Totally Wired was in the top 25,
in 1980.
Yeah, that's one of those facts that got bandied about before we got there, that we were a top 30 band in New Zealand, but. I'm not so sure we actually believed it, to be honest. I don't think I did. I don't think... Did you, Steve?
I wasn't... My Dream of a Casino Soul was in the charts, I think, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah, the following year, in 82, when you came in, and Hex was in the charts as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was top 15, I think, maybe.
I think cynically... We were probably thinking, how many records do you have to sell to get in the New Zealand charts?
Not many.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a percentage game, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I think the common thing I've heard is about if you make it in the charts, you need to sell about 500 in a week, I think, or something. 500 to 1,000.
Yeah. Stage was.
Suffice it to say, we didn't make any money out of it. So.
But yeah, Totally Wired had been in the charts the year before, and Grotesque had been released as well.
Yeah.
We had a DJ in New Zealand who was like a John Peel figure in a way, and he was playing the Fall for a year or two before you arrived. That was Barry Jenkin, and he was really behind the Fall. He loved the Fall, and that would have been the first time I heard the Fall would have been on his show at night, on his radio show at night.
It's a strange thing that it crossed over, isn't it? Because we couldn't get, in terms of chart, certainly then, we couldn't get arrested in the UK.
Yeah.
I mean, we never bothered in the charts, were we, at all, but at that stage.
New Zealanders were buying and were really hungry for interesting new music. You know, I look back and think about some of the things that were in the charts. And also, you know, the bands that toured here in that period.
Yeah.
It's incredible. I look back. I mean, I made a bit of a list earlier.
Go on, then. Let's have a listen.
All right. So, for your facts and figures, the first British new wave punk band, if you like, to play here was The Members. The following year, we had
The Members.
Yeah, we had Magazine and XTC the following year.
So, what year was this then? So, when did The Members tour?
1979.
Well, The Members sounded in the suburbs, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was around that time.
Right.
Magazine and XTC in 1980. The Cure and Echo and the Bunnymen in 1981. And 1982 was an absolute bumper year. We had The Clash, The Teardrop Explodes, The Fall, Simple Minds, and New Order.
Yeah. Wow.
And
all the same promoter.
Different promoters.
Was it Chris Knox?
No. I think Doug and Chris did The Fall and New Order that year. I'm not sure who did the others.
So Doug is Doug Hood.
Yeah. Sorry, we should probably also talk more about the about some of the names behind this.
Whenever there's Doug and Chris, they're thick as thieves together. So Chris Knox and Doug Hood are
Big part of the Flying Nun story.
Yeah.
So we should talk about Chris Knox. We'll get to that when we get to the record, because Chris Knox was the kind of the promoter, wasn't he? He brought us over. Because just to set a bit of background for anybody who doesn't know, we toured Australia quite extensively just before that. So we were all a bit frazzled by the time, I think. I think frazzled is a politer way of putting it as anything.
Quite an eventful tour, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yes. And fairly well documented by now. I think people can't stop writing books about it, can they still? So we arrived in New Zealand looking fairly dishevelled and fairly knackered. And the way I remember it is, we came out, obviously our luggage was worth about thump and tapeney, and there was a number of photographers there. Yeah. Were you there, Jonathan? Were you there when we arrived at the airport?
Not at Christchurch, no. Not even at Auckland airport, no.
So the photographer from the newspaper sort of said, you're going to have to look a bit better than this, lads. This is, you know, this is a big news story, this bad arrive in New Zealand.
I think that was the first time ever, don't you?
Well, and the last, I think.
First and last time ever.
My press at the airport, I think the last time ever as well.
I think so,
So, Mark came out and did that ridiculously happy sort of sachet, for want of a better word, which ended up on the front of the newspaper, much to Mark's chagrin, so shall we say.
Yeah, so
I think that's how it happened, wasn't it?
Yeah, and there's two newspapers in the in Christchurch. There's the Press, which is where the picture appeared, and the Star, and both papers covered it extensively. But the Press, there's a Flying Nun connection there. David Swift was one of the music writers for the paper. He also was a drummer in a Flying Nun band called Mainly Spaniards. And so he was tasked with putting a headline on the, and he was told to put a headline that would appeal to the grannies. And that's why Mark's picture, because he was smiling. I think he said, swinging the suitcase, the arrival lounge of the airport, I was told to put a caption in a way that the grannies would understand. So I did, with a little tongue in cheek. That's the way David described it.
Happy full guitarist, was
that's
it?
That's right. That yeah. And Mark's picture did appear in the paper as well, but in the inside. And he kind of gave this
never got over it.
Blazing interview where he just slagged off almost every band from Manchester and said that Joy Division was just a cheap band playing Doors licks. I think that was my favorite headline from that one. But, you know, to talk about the promotion, actually the Christchurch gigs, the town hall one, was put on by a local duo, one of which was Mary Rose Wilkinson, who went on to be in a Flying Nun band called The Renderers. And one of the reasons that there was so much, I'm sure you guys can talk about all the boot boys and stuff showing up, was they promoted the hell out of it, but no one bought any tickets in advance. So they didn't hire much security because they thought no one was going to show up. And
walk-up bundles.
Yeah. Little did they know that it was going to get inundated by the boot boys and get pretty hairy.
What flavor of boot boys were they in them days? Were they skinheads?
I suppose so.
That was a big problem. There was a big, maybe slightly earlier than that, but there's a big element of skinheads causing murder at gigs in England at the time.
I talked to a lot of people that went to those gigs, and you know, a lot of them are like 15 years old, and they were kind of slightly terrified about what was going on and kind of watched from the back. And I just remember all the boot boys going to the front and spitting at the band.
Yeah, they're, we've talked about that on this podcast a few times.
And
spitting at gigs is absolutely disgusting, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I just and the clean, the iconic Flying Nun band, the Clean, which had actually broken up by that point. They got back together specifically for that gig and the following the one at the university as well, and they were all took tabs of acid before the gig and then just proceeded to have cigarettes and beer bottles thrown at them for the entire show. And I talked to Bob Scott, who just remembers playing the keyboard and having a beer bottle smash against it as he was trying to play.
Yeah. It's a curious phenomenon in them days, wasn't it? How you showed your appreciation for a band.
Yeah.
You're going to throw bottles at them. I'm going to spit at them.
Yeah, I'm going to throw bottles, yeah.
Good times.
And then the ironic thing was that the university one there was no violence at all. No, none of the Boot Boys showed up for that one. And I don't know what your memories are, but everybody kind of says that show was a lot better.
Yeah.
So go on, Steve. Sorry.
I obviously read this recently that the first night was really bad and the second night was really good.
Mm. That's generally reaction.
Which one's the album? Which obviously we're going to get to the
second one. Obviously, the second one was the album. The
Auckland
one.
Yeah, we haven't got to Auckland yet. We're still
down on South Island.
Two in Christchurch, and then one in Wellington, which doesn't seem to be remarkable in any kind of way, and then the final two in Auckland. So I mean, it's kind of curious that they decided to use the Christchurch headline for the Auckland album, but I guess it was kind of the press of the time.
Yeah. So you played three gigs in New Zealand before you got to Auckland, but perhaps memories have faded a little bit.
But yeah, Jonathan was at the first night at Main Street.
So. I was just thinking though about the business of arriving at the airport, because Mark Smith said in his book that there was nobody at the airport, just five guys with long hair saying, "Get in the van."
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Okay, so since we recorded the first part of this interview, we have had a bit of a break in transmission due to technical issues, and we were talking about the gigs in the South Island where we were supported by the Clean. Now, one of the things, well, very sadly, since we first started talking, Hamish Kilgore, who was in the Clean, but was a kind of a giant in New Zealand music, really, in the Dunedin sound, has passed away. So I don't think we should really move on without speaking about him. So, Matthew, you were saying you found an interview with him where he discussed the fall. Is that right?
Yeah. So, when I was writing the book, Hamish was one of the first people I reached out to, and I met him in Detroit when the Clean played there in 2014, I think. And I went to New York a few months later and spoke to him for the book and interviewed him over several days, went back and forth for a few months. And I just went back and listened to the tapes because I remember we talked about the fall a lot. And, there's a few gems. He said, one of the things he remembers about that first gig, the university gig in Christchurch, was he said, the fall came on and I played, and I was just stunned how they played. He said they had two drummers, and I thought, my God, this is like hearing the Rolling Stones in 1964 or something. They were just so fucking good. And my mind was blown. And then he said the next night, he said he didn't speak to the band at all. And then the next night he saw, the only thing he said to Marky Smith is he saw him when he was going into the venue, and he said it was a really cold night in Christchurch. And he said it was fucking freezing. And he said, he saw Mark and he said, "It's cold out, isn't it?" And he said, "Oh, it's manky weather." And that was the only interaction with Mark. And, but he said, interesting for you, Paul, was he said he went in when there was sound check, and he said you were all setting up your gear and everything. And he went up to Carl and he said, "Oh, you know, I've got this Rogers drum kit and a Rogers snare, and you know, you wanted to see if he was interested in using it." And Carl was pretty abrasive. He said, "Oh, I'll bring it up here." And he's sort of tapped on it. He said, "Oh, I don't know." And Hamish just remembers that he was really obnoxious. And he said, "Oh, well, fuck you then, whatever." And walked out. And he said he remembers, he walked out in the main entrance, and he said he remembers you coming out and saying, "Oh, hey, you know, I hope you weren't offended by Carl or anything." But, and he just said, "Oh, you know, I remember that, that Paul was really cool." And, you know, I was sympathetic for Carl because he had such an attitude, but being in a band with Marky Smith, he would have an attitude.
Listen, unfortunately, he had enough attitude for both of us. So I had to be the, Yeah, I mean, you know, that's typical of Carl. That someone comes up and says, "I'd like to do you a favour here and make you sound better," and he'll bite his fucking head off. That's pretty much Carl's way of rolling. But I mean, sometimes Carl could be as nice as pie. But again, I mean, it's one of those things. I don't like the fact that people get credit for sometimes choosing to be nice, if you know what I mean. You're either a decent person or you're not. You know, the fact that you can switch it off and on, and I'm not really talking about Carl here, obviously, but people choose to switch it off and on, and then when they deign to be nice occasionally, everyone goes, "Oh, he was great to me," you know.
"Oh, he was great to me," yeah.
Yeah. So,
and, you know, just, and I think I mentioned to you, in our botched last recording, but he was at the Brownies gig in New York, and he went on a lot about that. Yeah, he was there.
He moved to America, didn't he?
Yeah, he moved to New York in the late 80s, and he was there for almost 30 years. Yeah, that's where.
Did you have anything to say about the Brownies gig?
Well, he said it was a fucking disaster. I think that was his exact words.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah. Yeah, I said that. I've seen the film of it. It sounds great, actually. I mean, when you actually get all five of them on the all stage, like that.
That's what I thought too. I watched that YouTube video. I thought, oh, you know, this is pretty great for most of it.
I mean, there's bits of it I could have done without, but it was pretty powerful, wasn't it? It's not. Yeah, I don't think it's how you'd best prepare for gigs, is it, Steve? It's not your favourite memory of playing.
Absolutely not. No.
So yeah, I went back and listened to a couple of interviews with Hamish myself, actually, and he was talking about the Boot Boys who came to the gig in Christchurch, and it all kicked off. Do you remember that, Steve?
I don't know. I don't. Do you?
No, not at all. No. I remember the New Zealand gigs being really sort of going down really well. And I mean, not that the two things are necessarily mutually exclusive, well, that you got people.
The town hall gig in Christchurch was, I think I mentioned this on the, in our previous recording, but yeah, Mary Rose Wilkinson, who was in the Renderers, she was behind that. And, the ticket sales weren't good. And so they didn't think anybody was good coming. So they didn't hire any security of any size. So it just, when the Boot Boys did show up, it just kind of, their presence was felt because no one was controlling it.
How many are we talking here? How many?
Well, I have people? A friend, Blair Parks, who was in a band called All Fall Down, which was on Flying Nun. And he remembers distinctly this this kid who was about 13 or in his school named Mark Fox, who got up on stage and was aping everything Marky Smith was saying. And Mark was saying, get him off the stage. And this kid was just dancing around. And then Jonathan actually pointed out, if you go to the fall gig guide, there's a whole line by line of what Mark is saying to him, get off the stage, get off the stage. And this kid is dancing around, mimicking him. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah, I've got a transcript here.
Yeah.
Right, here we are. Okay, can you get out? Have you got any security in here or anything like that? You know what I mean? Get this boy off the stage. Get him out. Right, if he wants to get on fucking stage, he should form a group or something, right? It's superstars or something. You read too many English magazines, mate.
And Blair was older than him. Blair was older than him, and he said he was like totally terrified. He was standing at the back, and there's this young kid like up front jumping on stage. Couldn't believe it.
Well, I'd been too scared to go and stand at the front of the stage, and I was in the fucking band, so good on him. So yeah, in the interview with Hamish, he said that a lot of the big boys were Polynesian. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess if that's, you know, if that's what Hamish's experience was, I mean, there were big boys around for sure. I mean, I remember, you know, at gigs, you would be quite, you'd be watching your back. You know, when I first started going to gigs, definitely, you know, a feeling that you'd be watching your back. Maybe something might kick off. I mean, I was lucky. I never really saw any real aggravation or violence, but
they used to just go to gigs looking for trouble.
Yeah. I found a little bit. So if anyone is interested in New Zealand music, they couldn't do better than to go to audioculture.co.nz, which is a great New Zealand music site with many, many hundreds now of stories about different New Zealand, yeah, all aspects of New Zealand music. It's a fantastic site. And I found a story about XS Cafe, which was an underage venue in Auckland in 1980 and 1981. And the guy who ran XS Cafe wrote a story, which is on Audio Culture. Just to sum up what he said about the Boot Boys, he says, this was Brian Staff, the Auckland Boot Boys were usually skinheads or sported number one haircuts and went out with girls who looked much the same. Some of these guys were in the army and came up by train from a camp in South Auckland to XS Cafe each Saturday night. A couple of years previously, the punk rock night spot had been a place called Zwines, where the Boot Boys' enthusiastic dancing tended to become a little rough and tumble, which often led to push and shove fist fights. XS Cafe was not as rough as Zwines, but would regularly have the toilet smashed in the men's room and holes punched through the jibboard wall. So one day, instead of replastering it, we bought a length of sheet steel and screwed it across the wall and painted it accordingly. And there weren't, he says there wasn't any more trouble after that. But further on in the article, he does say, the toilet was smashed most weekends. So yeah, if you're going to close a venue, then I think the first place you start is to smash the toilets.
Again, it speaks to that we were talking about before about shitting on your own dog. Why would you smash the toilets in a place you like to go?
Yeah,
what is that about?
It was a common thing. I mean, the Gladstone and Christchurch, which was the kind of epicenter for the scene there, had the same thing. You know, the toilets got smashed to pieces, and the bookers and the pub owners there just said, "Fuck this! We're going to bring in cover bands after that." And the amount of local bands that were attracting these Boot Boys, they did not get as many gigs there after that, and that was kind of the end of the Gladstone for a while, at least.
I can imagine.
Jonathan, you were saying you when you were digging up your pictures from the Main Street gigs, there were some Boot Boys in the pictures there too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, now that was interesting because I had not looked at the photos I'd taken of the support bands very closely for a long time. And when I scanned them again just in the last couple of weeks, the band Nocturnal Projections are playing, who are one of the support bands the night I went. And I can see two of the band on stage, but in the foreground of the picture are these two Boot Boy guys. I mean, I can't see them very clearly. I don't think they're real sort of shaved head sort of boy types, but, you know, and they're doing that sort of grappling dance where they kind of grab each other. They're kind of hunched over and they've grabbed each other and they're about to start jumping around. That's the only way I can describe it, which is probably why I took the photo. I mean, I really can't remember too much else about it, but yeah, there's this weird sort of, I don't know. I mean, Nocturnal Projections, you know, fantastic music, but yeah, maybe they just attracted a rougher sort of crowd. I don't know.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, that whole element of violence. I mean, it sounds pretty much worldwide, doesn't it? Maybe it was just when the fall play.
one of the stories I found, and I mean, this one, I kind of remember hearing about stuff like this, but Doc Martin boots were really sought after, and you couldn't get them very easily in New Zealand. And people would order them, they would mail order them from a catalogue, and they would take a very long time to get here. And, you know, they were very rare. Anyway, there was a band, the young guys who actually guys I knew from school, called the Screaming Mimis. And Mike, who was the guitarist, he described in the story again on Audio Culture about his experience wearing his new Doc Martens for the first time to a gig one night. So this is what he said. Walking to the gig in his brand new cherry red boots, and it tipped him upside down. Mike said, he was tapping my head against the footpath. I remember being worried about my hair, but I wasn't giving my boots up. They were bloody expensive and they'd taken 6 months to get here. He told the skinhead they were only size 8.5. And the reply was, I'll wear them as earrings then. Stop curling your toes. So Mike says, at that point of negotiation, I realized if I protested anymore, I was going to get another hiding, and I played the gig in my socks.
Oh, good times.
Oh, no.
I don't think tapping would be the word I'd use, as he's tapping my head against the because I think there must have been some kind of difficulty of getting hold of decent boots, because one thing I remember about the Australian, at the end, Carl sold one of the crew his boots.
Yeah.
I was going to say that Carl had Doc Martens, he would have sold them.
No, he didn't. Doc Martens, they were like sort of suede kind of Chelsea boots.
Yeah,
and he sold them to what was his name? The guy from the crew? I can't remember. But I remember Carl saw. And then the thing with Carl was, what you saw with Carl was what you got. So it wasn't like he could put his other pair of shoes on to go home.
No,
the shoes he had, the shoes he possessed. So the crew guy gave him a pair of old pumps. And I remember getting a postcard from the guy. Well, I wish I could remember his name. Really, the crew we had in Australia and New Zealand were fantastic. But
fantastic, weren't they?
Yeah. Send the postcard.
It was Mitch.
It might have been Mitch. Well, Mitch was definitely one of them. But he
was a town man. Yeah.
Yeah. Sent a postcard. These boots fucking stink, but they look great. Yeah. So there must have been a whole southern hemisphere shortage of decent footwear at that time.
Yeah. No, you couldn't get Doc Martin boots.
If you're going to want Carl's cast off, so then
you must be desperate for a decent pair of. Second Carl's. He didn't wear socks either. So,
oh God.
So he wore them every night for a 25-day tour. I bet they were fairly noisome by the end of that tour, weren't they? I was assuming they put them on for the first time the day he set off for the tour, which is in no way guaranteed, is it?
One thing about the tour, it sounds like you basically just played through whatever equipment you was available from the support bands. This is what Graham Jeffries from Nocturnal Projections said anyway. That
that would
basically
probably
be right.
That makes sense,
Because we obviously had a gear for the Australian bit, but we wouldn't have took that to, we wouldn't have took that to, when you can see exactly what we took with us on them photographs when you're out of the air.
On the cars.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Still drunk it.
Yeah, because Hamish couldn't. Hamish seemed to think he said the Killeen definitely didn't lend any of their gear, but he said it was quite easy to get gear in Christchurch. So he thinks probably that Mary Rose Wilkinson sourced gear for you guys. But yeah, Graham Jeffries wrote a memoir a few years ago, which I helped publish, and he writes about the Nocturnal Projections, who opened. Was it the first night, Jonathan?
I'm not sure.
I can't remember.
Yeah. So I didn't make it to the second night. That's another story.
Yeah. Yeah. There's several openers, but the Nocturnal Projections were lent the gear in Auckland for sure. And Graham talks bitterly about how Marky Smith almost broke his amp in the memoir. I remember that.
No, I'm not big on gratitude.
No.
Yeah, so we really just used bottled gear, I would imagine.
Yeah. And Mark played a bit of guitar.
And did you stay at Chris Knox's house?
Did we stay at Chris Knox's house?
I think we did, didn't we?
Yeah. You know where you stayed in a hotel.
I don't seem to remember staying in an hotel. I think we did stay at people's houses, yeah.
No, I seem to remember staying in some apartment, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we did that the whole tour. Even in Australia, we had these two apartments where the scumbags were in one, and Mark and Kay and the other the sound guy were in the others. So but I think that we didn't really do a lot of hotels in Australia and New Zealand. I don't know whether that's how it was.
We did have a hotel in Sydney, didn't we?
Yes, we did. Yes, it was in a particularly salubrious area, as I recall.
It was in King's Cross, wasn't it? Yeah. But it was four of us in there. Me, you, Mark and Craig in one room.
Yeah. Living the dream. So back to New Zealand then. So we did the two gigs. So we did the one at the town hall where it kicked off. And then we did the university where everything was good as gold, except Carl insulted the support man. And then we got to Auckland.
And then Wellington. And I remember Mark did an interview with the student paper there, and he was asked about the Killeen, and he said, you know, they're pretty good. That lead singer and the drummer, they're quite interesting. And the interviewer says, well, they're brothers. And he said, oh, they're brothers. They could do anything. But little did he know that they'd already broken up.
Ladies and gentlemen, is the nearest he ever gave to me and Steve got to give me a compliment. But I've been watching bits of the Killeen. They are really good, aren't they?
Yep.
Oh yeah. And they'd broken up at that point. So they broke up in May of 82, and they heard that so they just got back together for those two gigs in Christchurch, and then they split up again. And they didn't get back together.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they didn't get back together until 1988. Yeah.
I was just watching Quickstep, which is a song by them. I'm definitely getting a bit of a fall influence in that.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. But you know, all the one of the other bands that opened up in Auckland was led by Bill Doreen, and he had kind of tons of different names over the years. At that time, he was playing as Max Quits, I think. But he was in a band called The Builders, and he was heavily influenced. He was definitely into The Fall as well. And Jonathan will remember some of the other bands that opened up, but there was kind of a who's who of Flying Nun attended all these gigs. The Verlaines were in town. They were recording probably their famous single, Death and the Maiden, at that time. And they were in town and were at those gigs, and probably at the party. You probably met them, but probably don't remember it. But everybody was there.
I can't remember anything. We're terrible.
No.
Yeah. I mean,
so go on, Jonathan. Yeah.
When I look back now, the support bands at the gigs, I only went the first night, but yeah, certainly when I think about, you know, who was there, in terms of like people I got to know in later years, it's like so many people there, and you know, I just didn't know them yet. Yeah. You know, people who became good friends later on. Yeah.
Must be like the Free Trade Organ to the Sex Pistols. We were at that fall gig in 1982. Yeah. Yeah. Everyone there went on to form a band.
I mean, for me, it just sort of, you know, when I look back at it now and think, yeah, there was just so many people there that I didn't, you know, I didn't know them yet, but I came to know them. Yeah. First night, I think it was the Bombers, Nocturnal Projections with playing support, and then Coalition, who I'm pretty sure, I don't think I saw. I didn't take a photo of them anyway. And I'm not sure who played the next night. Yeah, Matt, you're right. I think the Verlaines were recording. I don't know if they played the support.
Yeah, Bilderin and the, Herbs. They were called the Herbs.
Children's Hour, maybe.
Yeah.
Might have played.
How many bands were there?
Yeah, and interesting, I was in Wellington last month, and the entire Flying Nun master tapes are all been donated to the National Library there. And I was curious if the master tapes for Fall in the Hole were there. Mm-hmm. And they have recordings from one of the opening bands as well, Bilderin. I think three or four songs of Bilderin's are on there as well. So they're all sitting there waiting for someone to, if anybody's listening and wants to do a proper reissue.
I'm pretty sure that the reissues of Fall in the Hole are mastered from the vinyl. So if they've got the master tapes, I'm sure somebody would be interested in.
Jonathan and I have talked about this.
Yeah. They are, to the point where one of the reissues had a you could hear the like pop of lean on the vinyl popping on the CD. I mean, that's not good, is it?
Yeah,
that's the audio equivalent of Carl's boots. That
I'm really not sure whether it's ever been remastered from those tapes or not. But that, yeah, as Matt says, those tapes are there now. They're being they've been. Put into an amazing archive anyway. And that's what I mean by that is that, yeah, it's now, they're now in a, you know, a temperature controlled environment and, you know, hopefully, you know.
Rather than sitting in Chris Knox's house for the last 40 years or whatever.
Yeah. I'm sure Chris had a lot of stuff that went there for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess we should say for people who don't know who all these people are is, you know, the two people responsible for the Fall in the Hole tapes are Chris Knox, who is
I thought you were talking about Spongebob. Yes, in, Chris Knox and Doug Hood are the two people who were behind.
Doug Hood, and they were kind of Flying Nun's de facto representatives in Auckland and responsible for a lot of the bands up there. They would record, Jonathan can talk about Doug maybe a bit more in more detail, but he would book gigs all over town and bring in out of town bands. And he recorded The Queen, their famous Boodle 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 EP, and a ton of other Flying Nun bands. But both him and Chris were kind of responsible for everything that was happening around there at that time.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say, Jonathan?
Yeah. And, you know, Doug went on to be a promoter, and I just look at the bands that he brought over, and it's just the most amazing lineup, really. I mean, my whole young adult life was kind of defined by going to these gigs and seeing names are going out of my head: John Cale, New Order, John Cooper Clarke. Lou Reed later on in the 80s. Doug became involved with the Big Day Out in the
1990s.
Okay. The Ken West,
wasn't it, Big Day Out? Was he more involved in the Australian tour? I think he did the whole thing. I can't remember.
I'm not sure how it was split up. I mean, it certainly started in Australia, and then Auckland became just one of the shows on the schedule. Yeah. And with a Big Day Out, it would be 90% the same as what was being presented in Australia, but there might be more emphasis on bands that, you know, New Zealanders wanted to see, I guess, or more local bands. An amazing run of shows there as well. Doug brought Nirvana to New Zealand, I think, for the first time in the 90s.
Sort of a bit later.
It was like, yeah, that's sort of much later. Yeah.
And he was also manager of the Chills, yep, which were kind of the flying nun band to make it overseas. And you know, Chris bought the kind of famous story to tell, I guess, is that Chris bought with some inheritance money, bought a 4-track, which he recorded all his own music with. But him and Doug would record gigs all the time. And that's how Fall in the Hole was recorded. Yeah. The Teak 4-track was.
So is that that party? You mentioned a minute ago where they came up with the brilliant idea of doing a record? So there's a bit of a discrepancy, isn't there, as to whether they said it was just for New Zealand or whether it was. I think people have got different opinions, haven't they?
Well, where to begin with that story?
Yeah.
Several people have said, yeah, the party happened and they kind of, I don't know if you guys remember if it was before the gig or after the gig, because it seems to be some discrepancy of when this all happened. But I don't know if you have any memory of the party at all. It seems to be quite a famous party.
I wouldn't have thought it was before the gig. I seem to remember it being after, yeah.
We're all very professional. We wouldn't have a party before a gig.
Well, I mean, Chris wrote a little liner note for the CD reissue, the second CD reissue. And he basically describes it kind of as a gentleman's agreement, handshake agreement, where he played back the tapes and everybody thought they were great. And can we put this out? And, oh, yeah, sure. Why not? How official it was. Jonathan has a story about a famous letter. He can say more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I looked back at what was written and riffed up in the local music magazine, and so in August 83, so I think the album came out in November or December. In August 83, it was sort of being teased with the official okay for the album came recently in a letter from singer Marky Smith. Smith also expressed a wish to return to these shores. And about that time, I had, how can I put this? I had a whole lot of photos. Okay, so as you know, I took a whole lot of photos at the gig and a whole lot of photos at the record shop. And Chris Knox heard that I had these photos. I didn't actually know him, but I was taken there and introduced to him by a mutual friend. And Chris was like, yep, great, these photos are great. And I thought, oh, great, now I'm going to have my photos on the album sleeve. And he's like, no, the sleeve's already done, but I'm going to do an insert as well. And I went, oh, okay, so and use your photos for the insert. And I said, yep. And then he said, I also had some clippings, reviews and stuff like that. And Chris was really keen on all that aspect of it as well. Yeah. So I lent him all that stuff, which he had copied and was used for the insert. And I also agreed to print some photos for him or for Flying Nun. In the end, I think Roger Shepherd from Flying Nun paid for the photos I printed. So one night, me and a friend went to Chris and Doug's house where they lived with their partners at the time. And I arrived there with his photos, and the conversation sort of came around in a fairly loose way to the letter that had just been received from Mark Smith, and would we like to see this letter? And we were like, yeah, sure, we'd love to see a letter from Mark Smith. So I've seen the letter, but I can't tell you any of the details about what it said about.
Come on.
What it said about whether they could release it. Well, I don't think I sat there and read the whole thing, but what Doug and Chris wanted us to see was the last line in the letter where Mark Smith signed off by saying, I got married last week. Or something like this. So they were kind of amazed by this, I think, that he would just kind of drop this in right at the end of the letter with no other detail at all. just this sort of, I got married last week, letter in. So that really, I'm afraid, is the only detail I can remember.
Right. So the big sticking point is whether it was agreed that it could be distributed anywhere except New Zealand, isn't it? That's what Mark.
Yeah.
And the fact that it had Mark Riley on the front cover was another bone of contention, I think. But
yeah. But the story in Rip It Up.
Well, and I think, you know, to put this into. I think we should put it in some context of terms of what Flying Nun was operating like at that time. You know, they were in pretty difficult financial situation, the kind of situation like Hamish would talk about. You know, a check would come in the mail, they'd run down to the bank, cash it so they could pay for the next pressing, the next covers. And, you know, they were pressing 300, 500 copies of a record, maybe 1,000. And then all of a sudden, there's going to be a double fall record. And the pressing was much, much higher than anything they'd done before that. So, you know, they saw an opportunity with it. And I think they kind of wanted to run with it because at that time, you know, it was tough for a lot of the bands. You know, the records would come out. They'd go up on the charts and they'd disappear the next week because they'd run out of stock and they wouldn't be able to repress them. But, and so they had a lot riding on this record for sure.
Yeah. So what was the, I wonder what, you wouldn't be able to answer this, but I was wondering what they did. Who were we with then, Steve? What label were we on? Were Camera was still going by then, by the time it came out? Or had we gone back to Rough Trade by the time that came? I think we probably had, haven't we? We've probably gone back to Rough Trade by then.
We'd probably gone back to Rough Trade, yeah, and then didn't copies of it start showing up at Rough Trade in England, import copies?
That's the story, yeah. And then Chris got the phone call from Marky Smith yelling down the line, what the fuck is this? And basically, you know, it's funny because it showed up in the charts for 1 week and then it disappeared. So from what Roger wrote in his memoir and what Hamish has told, it basically, there was an export ban and a huge amount of the sales were for people overseas. And there's all these reports in the press of 800 copies being, pre-sold to people overseas. So there weren't a lot, there a huge amount of the records were actually being allocated for people overseas and suddenly they couldn't sell any of them. And Hamish talks about being in the office and just being surrounded by boxes and boxes of boxes of record that they couldn't sell.
It'd be worth a few bob now, though, I think.
Well, they kind of reached a secret deal with a label in Wellington called JRM. So they would sell them in bulk to them, and then JRM would sell them into Europe. And they would be sold at very inflated prices.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the stories I tell, though, is that, you know, it almost bankrupted the company, but one of the interesting things, it is also kind of the savior of the company because in February of 84, John Peel gets a hold of a copy and he plays it on his show every week for over a month. And it's the first Flying Nun record ever to only the second, I guess, Flying Nun record ever to be played on Peel's show. And he kind of starts a link between Peel and Flying Nun. And from there, you know, after he starts playing all those tracks off Fall in a Hole, a few months later, he's playing other bands like The Great Unwashed, which was Hamish's band after the Clean, and Children's Hour, The Chills. And The Chills went over on tour there in 1985. And it kind of just started the ball rolling for Flying Nun in Europe after that.
You can't have been that pissed off, Mark. If John Peel was playing it every week, surely Mark would have got to hear about that as well. So the cease and desist can't have been too strong, can it?
I think he got his money in the end, too.
Did he?
So, yeah. As far as I know. Good. Yeah. 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 So, can't have been too mad about it.
It's available now, isn't it? You can still buy it now, I think, can't you? What labels it all? But I suppose Cherry Red have got it now, haven't they? They've got everything else.
It was part of that Fall 82 box set. That's a few years ago now. Yeah. About to say last year, but no, it wasn't. That was 2019, I think, that came out.
So the rights reverted to the Fall at some point, presumably.
I don't know if there's any rights at all. I think they just presume that the rights are theirs. I mean, I don't know if Chris Knox or Doug Hood were consulted at all. I just think they assumed because it's, you know, it came out under their name. I don't think there's any paperwork anywhere or anything like that, any contracts.
Yeah, that's the court case out then, Steve. There's no paperwork. We'll never be able to sue for our share.
Because, Jonathan, isn't there live tracks from some of the other gigs on there?
Yeah,
on that
there
box
is.
Set as well?
Yeah. There's
yeah.
Oh well, there's a set from the Australian tour, and there's which is a CD in itself, and there's all
is that the Melbourne live to air one?
Yeah, the Melbourne live to air one. And there's
I think I'm right in saying that was before Carl arrived. That so there was just me on the drums on that one. I think you're
right. Yeah,
because famously Carl was late,
and I think there's various other tracks. Other tracks that Chris and Doug recorded as well have ended up on there, but how they came there from, no, it's a bit of a mystery.
So the original record, did it have a single with it? Was it a 45, the second disc?
Yeah.
45 RPM?
Yeah.
Yeah. It did.
Yeah, they famously ran out of tape, and so I think part of the last songs, which is the encore, are on the 45, and they're not off the four track, right, Jonathan? They're just like a fan's recording off a tape recorder or something?
Yeah, it's Chris must have edited all this. It sounds quite brilliant because the first track on the 45 of the first track of the encore is Fantastic Life, and that sounds great. That's off the four track for sure. Then it goes to English Scheme, and that's off the cassette because you can hear it. Suddenly, it's just sounds more muffled.
Right.
And then suddenly he's edited the end of that with the crowd noise straight back into whatever the third track on that side is. Sorry, I can't quite recall at the moment. But it's took quite a lot of trouble. You can tell when you listen to it to you know, splice the tape to make it all work. But yeah, when you listen to it on CD now, I mean, it's still actually the cherry red one. I think sounds great. It's really come up well. But where it was mastered from, I have no idea. I don't know whether it was done off the tape. I don't think it's off. I don't think it's off the record though. I think it's
right.
It sounds
well. I mean, I wouldn't know. Nobody asked.
Yeah.
Nobody asked me.
No.
Yeah. No.
Did you hear about it at the time? Did Mark complain about it to you within your career?
We did hear about it at the time, yeah. I don't remember him going too mad. I know he hated the cover. I know that. I remember that. I remember him being really pissed off about the cover. Rather than I have more of a memory of that than him being pissed off about the existence of the album, I think.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
And yet he claimed in his book. He claimed in his book that the cover was his idea.
I think he had to make.
Yeah, that's a lot of bollocks. That's absolute tripe. That.
He was
incensed.
Yeah.
No, that's not true.
I mean, that's sort of understandably, in a way, because Mark had just gone by then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Mark was in the pressure of being pushed out in the process of being pushed out the door the whole way through the tour, really. But there's a bit on your website where it says Mark starts to try and sing Look No.
Yeah.
Mark Smith walks over and pushes the microphone away from him.
It was because I was right up the front and I just remember watching this and thinking, that's interesting. The microphone, I'm just going to move that away from your mouth now so that you can't carry on singing. Thank you. It was.
Well, Jonathan, what is your memory of the mood at that the in-store where you took all those great photographs that are what was the mood like there?
I remember there not being, there wasn't a great amount of people there, was there?
No, I mean, it's sort of hard to tell because I didn't really take a photo of. I should have, stepped back. I should have done a lot of things. I should have stepped back and taken a photo of the whole store, but I didn't. I don't think there were a great many people there. But, the people who were there seemed to – I mean, I was pretty shy and I didn't really talk to anyone. I think my friend and I talked to Mark Riley a little bit and we talked a little bit to Kay as well, but didn't really talk to any of the rest of you. And I mean, you know, I was really shy. You know, I was 18, and you guys were like, you know, you were like my hero.
Well, I was only 18. Oh, hang on a minute. I wasn't even 18, I don't think. We were just about 18, yeah. So we would have been the same age. We could have bonded over our cans of Warm Fosters.
Yeah, no, I mean, I knew. Yeah, you definitely seemed like the youngest of the crew, Paul, that's for sure.
I certainly was the youngest.
I was there. I mean, I remember arriving.
I think that's got to be the first in-store thing we ever did, isn't it?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Was that the first thing that you...
I'm a lot of it, yeah. No. Did a few more successful ones.
I think one thing that becomes clear from the photographs, which they are fantastic, those shots from the record shop. One, not in evidence, I think one of the reasons there weren't many people there was the same reason Carl Burns wasn't there, because it was too early for Carl.
Yeah.
He never got out of bed in time to get down there.
He did turn up. He is in one of the photos towards the end.
Is he?
Yeah, I'll send it to you so you can
see. Yeah, I'll have a look at his boots.
Yeah. Oh, well, he can't. Yeah, no, it's behind the shop counter, unfortunately. Now, the guy who ran that record store, he was really onto it, and just in terms of promotion, and he, he had all the, he ordered all the hip imports. He really had us eating out of his hand, really. That was one of the few places where you could buy, you know, import records. And he was really, you know, he really saw an opportunity there. It was only the only place I found it advertised was in Rip It Up magazine. Cause I did wonder, like, how the hell did we know that it was going on? Radio B, student station wasn't on air that week, that month even. And yet, you know, I went down there with my mate. We, we knew about it. We pretty much got up that morning and left the house and disappeared for the afternoon. But yeah, that record shop, he had a huge, he had an enormous copy of the sleeve of the artwork from the Lie Dream of a Casino Soul sleeve in the window. So as you walked up Queen Street, you saw just the enormous.
Well, that was our big hit, wasn't it, in Australia? In New Zealand.
Faces were in the window. Yeah. And if you look at, you know, the Palace of Swords reversed album? Look at the back of that. There's a photo of Mark Smith smoking a cigarette, and he's got the black eye, and you can see the window of the shop behind him. So that was taken that day.
Right. That's it. What, it lingered on that black eye then, didn't it?
Sorry.
That was about 3 weeks later. It must have given me an eye bleeding lamp.
Yeah.
Well, deservedly so.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because it's covered in makeup. It's covered up, isn't it, on the TV thing. So it must have been quite the shiner.
Yeah.
In one of my photos, you can still see the stitches. I didn't notice for years. But
Hamish said he remembers when they were in Christchurch. He remembers him having it.
Good times. I can't get a picture of this. I can't find the figure. I got the front of it, but I can't see the back. You can't see that. I was looking for the picture of him in the black. Never mind. I shall find it at a later day. So, So I remember that was a great record shop, that. I bought the Banana album there by the Velvet Underground, it didn't have a banana on it. It had a different cover.
Oh, okay.
I wish I still had it. I bet it'd be worth a few bob that now.
Yeah. Well, what I should have been, if we'd known, I would have been urging you to buy everything on Flying Nun that you could find in the shop, because you would be, you'd be cashing in now.
Really?
Yeah, it can be.
Yeah. Fall in the hole. I mean, fall in the hole is
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. Mm. Well, the original pressing.
Yeah, I just got that new record collector special on the hall. And there's some super fan in there who has everything. And he says the one thing he doesn't have is original pressing of Fall in the Hole.
Wow.
That makes three.
What's his name? Nigel Reeve.
Right. If we're going to go down that route of the things I should have kept hold of, dear me.
God,
exactly.
That auction.
The interesting thing is, I don't have a copy of it. I'm a super fan, and I don't have a copy of it. I don't know. But the interesting thing is, what I bought what I thought was a copy in Germany, and then I realized it was bootlegged in Germany.
Wow.
So there's a version of it that's out there that was bootlegged, and it's got a bad pressing, so it skips on one of the tracks. I can't remember which one, but it looks fantastic. The cover is great and everything, but at some point in the 90s, I guess, somebody in Germany was bootlegging copies of it on vinyl.
Wow. What a bloody chic.
So good luck to you. Yeah, I think, you know, what would you say, Jonathan? About $200, I think, to get a copy of that now, I would say, probably. Original copy of Fall in the Hole.
Not sure.
It's obscene. Yeah,
it would be.
But, someone just needs to get down to Wellington and get those master tapes and
get some pressed up. Yeah.
All there.
Yeah, because like the people who've poured over Fall records wouldn't know the difference, would they? They wouldn't be saying. Actually, I think you'll find that there was three scratches on the run out of the original, whereas on this one. But I mean, if we start getting into that of the stuff that I should have kept hold of, I don't think any of us have really, have we, in the band? No, I've not got original copies of any of the records at all. I don't think.
Really?
No. Wow. Nothing.
Oh.
I know. And you look on that auction site, and the set list written by Mark's going for like £800 or whatever. Well, ridiculous. Maybe not that much, but I could have papered my bedroom with handwritten set list by Mark E. Smith at one stage. But who ever thought that they'd be worth keeping hold of?
But there's podcasts about the fall and everything. Testament.
We've talked about this before. Who thought in 1982, 83 that people would still be talking about I know two of them were there, but or three of us were there, but
no one.
There'd be any interest in that kind of stuff?
No one.
40 years on, it's incredible.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's not just the fall either, is it? It's, you know, people are still talking about, you know, music, I think, then was seen as a sort of, for now, you know, be here now kind of thing, whereas it's gone completely the other way now, hasn't it? It's all like...
And Jonathan, I think you've said to me many times, if you had kind of known then what you know now, you would have photographed a lot more of these bands that you went and saw, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, no, I would have. I
always regret that, not taking a camera with me.
Sure, yeah, it would have been. would have tried to do a lot more, for sure. But, yeah, perhaps you just don't realise at the time.
Because John Marr Buscox, he always had a camera with him. He's a bit of an amateur. He's a brilliant photographer, but anyway. But and you know, I just thought that wouldn't it have been great to have a camera and just sort of take not like pose, just like to get the
God, yeah.
Wouldn't it have been amazing?
You got some shots, wouldn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
The goings on in dressing rooms and everything else.
Yeah. But I mean, I think presumably part of the reason that this stuff sought after is because nobody did that, I suppose, isn't it? It sort of builds itself in, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it felt.
And you know, printing these days, set lists, aren't they? They're not worth anything. They're all done on the computer. Whereas Matt used to write them.
I mean, I think about, you know, I took photos at the gig, and I started taking, you know, more photos at gigs. And it was kind of a way, I guess, of. You know, sort of hanging on to some memories of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing was that it was just so, you know, the fall came here in 1982. I mean, it wasn't like I was in the UK. I couldn't go and see them the next week and take more photos there. That was it. It was all over, you know. And it just did feel so far away from all of that kind of stuff. I mean, I saw a photo book some English guys did a few years ago. I mean, he followed New Order around for a number of years in the early days and went to lots of their gigs and took many photos. And when I saw that, I thought, yeah, that would be amazing. But yeah, this is the thing that I only saw them once back then, you know, when I was in a position to be there with a camera. Sure, I mean, they did come back and I took some photos of them at other gigs, but yeah, maybe it's just that sort of thing about being there for the first time as well. I did see the Fall again in 1990 at the Auckland Town Hall. Steve, you were still there, I think.
No, I was still there. Yeah, yeah.
It's not sure.
Yeah,
that's a question. Yes.
No, she was.
Yeah, she was. We come on, move it. We've established that she was.
I'm coming to this a bit late, but yeah, no, she was there and Martin as well, because Martin was wearing the silver shirt.
Silver shirt, yeah.
That he wears on the cover of Extricate, because when he came on stage, I thought, oh, he's wearing the same shirt he's wearing on the LP. Yeah.
So is that the silver shirt? Speaking of, is that the one that went up for auction? Is that the same silver shirt?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is. Yes, I think so.
All right. How much did it go for? Do we know?
I don't know. No. But then, yeah, again, then we go back in 90. So we go back in 99, and there's still trouble.
Yeah, yeah. Same bloody nonsense again.
Yeah.
I mean, luckily for Mark, they didn't.
They didn't.
Services weren't dispensed with while we were halfway around the world, were they?
No.
Better, much better venue though, Steve. The Auckland Town Hall is, you know, that's a beautiful hall to play in. It's a
beautiful venue, yeah. It's fantastic. I remember that was a good gig. That was a good tour.
Yeah, it's a
good
venue.
Well, if I mean, for people, so the reason it's called Fall in a Hole is because Main Street was such a hole that Doug and Chris decided to call it that because they thought that Main Street as a venue was such a shithole, they'd call it Fall in a Hole.
Yeah, it had been a cabaret. it had this sort of cabaret history. And because it was a cabaret, you could get in if you were 18, which was very handy.
Oh, right, because most places 21 then.
Well, New Zealand was 20 then. It's 18 now.
20?
It was 20 then.
Okay.
Yeah. But at Main Street, yes, you could get in when you were 18, much to my parents' fury.
I always thought the Fall in a Hole was some kind of self-deprecating reference to New Zealand, not the venue. Which it wasn't a hole, I thought. It was a great question, isn't it? I mean, it was, you know, but I don't think the venue was particularly worse than a lot of places we played, to be honest. That was the kind of venue we were used to playing. It was sort of rundown music halls.
Yeah.
Manchester was full of them.
Yeah. And no toilet backstage. I think that was probably the...
What's toilet backstage?
No toilet backstage. No, you would have had to have taken your chances with the boot boys.
Well, you know
what it's like. Or hang on, I suppose.
Yeah, you know what it's like when you're a star. You don't want to be mixing with the, you know, the punters.
No.
You don't want to get knocked on the way to the toilet.
No, it's
like anybody in it.
Yeah.
Right, so that was Main Street was the hole, wasn't it?
Yep.
Main Street was the hole.
I saw some amazing gigs there, but it was not well ventilated. So in the summer, it was just the ceiling, you would get wet from condensation, you know, the floors were wet, the walls were wet, the ceiling would drip on you. This was sort of like during the summer. It was
a wonderful experience going to a gig in 1982, wasn't it? It all needs catered for.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many people do you think were packed into that place, Jonathan?
Well, Chris said on the sleeve that it was Perhaps 600. I meant to get the record out and have a look. I think perhaps 800 would have been its maximum, would have been its absolute limit. It wasn't big, you know, but there was sort of a mezzanine
round. That's quite a lot for us at that time, though, to play to that many.
Yeah. I think there would have been a couple of hundred people in there for sure. Perhaps 500-600. I'd have to have another look at the sleeve of the record, because Chris does actually say how many he thought were there on the night.
Well, what's your favourite track off the record, Jonathan?
I like English Scheme, actually. I just like that sort of roughness, that rough version. And I like...
Is it a rough version? I must admit, I'm not massively familiar with the album as a piece of work.
No. Yeah. Steve? Not for a few years.
No, we can't get one. I mean, I always liked the versions we did on that tour of the Room to Live stuff. I always thought that they really came into their own when we started playing them live.
Yeah. Oh, no, we were good by that time. We'd been constantly touring for 6 weeks, haven't we?
About as good as we ever got, I think. Or maybe we were just knackered by then, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, remember what Hamish said? He was like seeing the Rolling Stones at 64. Well, so that's an endorsement in itself, right? Yeah, there you go.
It wasn't like seeing the Rolling Stones at Hyde Park, which is possibly the worst gig I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Awful. Right. On that bombshell, gentlemen, I think finally we can say we've got there. We were beset by problems left and right, but we finally got the recording. It's been absolutely a pleasure to speak to you. Obviously, you. Must appreciate you getting. What time is it then? So, just for purposes of the tape, it's 9:33 in the UK. So, what is it where you are, Jonathan?
10:33 PM.
Wow.
No.
Yeah.
And it's 1:30 in the morning.
Oh my God!
Vancouver, Canada, for me. Yeah.
Well, that's above
there you go.
We must.
Yeah. Thank you for your patience.
That's really good, and thanks for your patience.
I wouldn't have. No, it was lovely to do this.
Paul, can you perhaps fade us out with when you put this together with that great version of Hark the Herald Angels Sing? That's a particular favourite of mine. The full
version. You've got it. Yeah. If I can get that, well, it's what's it in it? It's traditional R, isn't it? So there's no copyright on that, so we won't get done. So yes, I shall certainly do that.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Have a good one.
Have a good one.
Having said that, this isn't going out until after Christmas, so I hope you had a good Christmas. We'll edit that in. Did you? Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Happy New Year.
Good New Year, was it?
Yep. Thank you.
Good.
To all of you. Absolutely. Good. Yeah.
Happy New Year.
All right.
Yeah.
All the best. Bye. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Old Brother. The next episode will be released in just under 2 weeks, hopefully, all being well. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Old Brother Show, where you can find links to our Spotify playlist. Or you can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS, and you'll be all set for the rest of Series 3. You can give us a rating on iTunes, subscribe on YouTube, or just tell your friends if you fancy it too. Further reading, our books about the fall, The Big Midweek and Our Bleeding Guest, are available from Root Publishers and all good bookstores. Needles and Plastic is available from bookstores everywhere, Third Man Record storefronts, and direct from thirdmanbooks.com. Hope to speak to you all again soon, and remember, if you're driving, take your car. Ta-ra!
One-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way. Because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.